Well, as I mentioned, some nutcake said, it's going to get easier. And we're really coming up probably the hardest part of the whole book.
Yeah, this is good stuff.
The seven sermons of the dead, we'll talk about that. And I actually, as I told you also, I'm just a couple of pages ahead of you. So I neglected to observe that we're referenced to the back in a couple of footnotes that you haven't read, but I think we'll go there anyway. And then, Jane, when we do take that little excursion to Appendix C, it's the first reference to Abraxas, then I'll turn it over to you. I think we'll get there today. Well, actually, this is really an important segment because we're seeing resolution, a very important resolution between, you might say, spirit and matter. We had the dead woman appear, and we'll be talking about that, the dead, a lot more because of the seven sermons to the dead. Remember, the dead would refer to those past truths which have been disregarded because they were couched in superstitions or mythological thinking. The other way he puts it, we'll see in a footnote, they're the unanswered questions from that past time. In other words, how did Christianity go from being the organizing principle of society to, at best, marginal, even a parasite on society? And he feels that he's drawn back to past issues and past questions, not in a romantic sense, but to begin to address what was understood and what was not understood, and then bring it forward to this time. For example, alchemy, which was once a literal pursuit, he brought back as a symbolic process of the psyche. And we can look more at of what practically is involved, but that's the basic issue. And so that initiated then this dialogue where Jung riles at the soul who appears after the dead woman, and so does Philemon, and suddenly the criticisms that they're making of the soul, we see the soul speaking about herself, and that's the first time we've seen that. Up to now it's been wisdom and then the young woman, as if wisdom moved him out of life and desires of the flesh seem to be in conflict with that in one sense, but in a way also serving it in that, remember that statement, the original fault comes from the body. So that, he could see, was was not untrue, but it put him in a terrible position because it forced him in following this to those two women. That's how I'd understand it. But pretty soon, this woman who's been always putting pressure on him starts to be critiqued, and she hears the critique. So that dichotomy of what the body is asking of him to finish his work starts to be mitigated. That's why I think it's so important. But we left off then on 344, the first column, just about a fifth of the way down the page, O bitterness. And that's just more of his complaining. How bitter it is to have had to take his desirousness seriously, what that cost him in terms of his marriage, on the one hand, and also knowing that's the route he had to go in order to have his soul communicate the ideas to him which are becoming Jungian psychology. So you've dragged me through sheer and utter hell. You've tormented me nearly to death. I'm bitter. You are great. I'm only your eunuch. I fished you from the swamp, meaning he, that I think would be a legacy of the Freudian work, that he had recovered respect for his sexual desire and his eroticism, but it started to cost him quite a bit. And that really, that basic thread continues pretty much down that page. She says, "Oh, have compassion on me." He says, "Compassion? Have you ever had compassion for me?" And that, I think we can see that goes down to, "While I spoke to my soul in this way, Philemon stood silently and spoke my name." So now we're going to see a huge shift. "You are blessed, virgin soul, praise be your name. You are the chosen one among women. You are the God-bearer, praise be to you, honor and fame be yours in eternity." So he's speaking to the woman in Jung's name. And remember, just about a page back, he was telling her she's a bitch, she's a whore, she's a seductress, but he's completely flipped. He's completely flipped.
But Philemon is guiding him in this. He's providing words.
Yes.
Well, that's Philemon's foot, too, because Philemon is saying
yes.
He's a whore, right?
Okay, so that's Philemon.
He stepped forward, he laid his hand on my shoulder and spoke in my name. So Philemon's speaking to her. "You live in a golden temple. We, your vassals, wait on your words." Now, why has there been a flip? I think we get it in the next sentence. And this is so important. "We drink red wine, dispensing a sacrificial drink in the recollection of the meal of blood that you celebrated with us." Now remember that quote I gave you from Visions? I'll read it to you again. "Sometimes one is allowed by the gods to substitute wine for blood, but that will come later." Remember, that was the situation of Christiana Morgan in her affair with Henry Morgan. Somebody said, "Well, why can't she work that out in imagination, in acts of imagination?" And that's his response, that you can't solve everything in imagination. Sometimes you have to live the experience first. Who decides? Not you, but the self. But what's happening here is he is now getting to the point where he doesn't have to live it out anymore. He can solve it in wine, not in blood. That is to say, a man or a woman who's paying attention to their anima or animus projections can be true to their desire for that other person and then say, "Who is that person in me? What's this experience asking of me? How can I learn the lesson this attraction is trying to communicate to me without making a mess of everything?" That's substituting wine for blood. That's what we've achieved. That's huge. That is integrating the anima.
Well, okay, what happened to Christiana? If you want to say something about that.
Well,
obviously she didn't do that.
She didn't do that. We don't know why. Of course, that one woman wrote a book saying it was Jung's fault. But I think two things stand out. Maybe three things. She wasn't being honest with Jung. We read in some of her letters at the end of that book by, what's her name, Claire Douglas, that she wasn't telling Jung all her dreams.
Now you're talking about...
This is a course we did 5 years ago, where a woman's having an affair, and it actually ends quite badly. She ends up committing suicide 50 or 30 years later, but still, her life never
just went to hell.
Basically went to hell, yeah. First thing, she wasn't being honest. Secondly, I don't know if you remember, the very first dream she had was that a lamb was pregnant and was too young to carry the pregnancy. So I'm thinking she was just too young. It was an extraordinary time in history. Part of the problem, I think, emerged because her husband was wounded in World War I. Gassed. So another factor would be this whole love problem emerged out of the damage of World War I, and it was too much for her to cope with. So I would say those two reasons.
Well, and just the time, but I mean, I'll always have that question. The time, the women were still so not able to,
not to mention
that, to themselves.
Yeah, that it was shameful. Well, it's almost.
I thought, why didn't she get a car and leave? Until I thought Henry Ford didn't have those Fords coming off the line yet.
Yeah.
Well, the first one came off in 1903, so we're talking World War One was a few years. But still.
But so she was Boston, which is very conservative. Remember, books were still banned in Boston.
She was still going in the 50s. Right?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know what she was, suicide. I mean,
she just got so sick, became an alcoholic. I didn't believe she developed cancer, yes. I'm not sure.
Yeah, she died of, well, she had cancer and then she committed suicide rather than.
And she was seeing patients at Harvard Psychological Clinic in, I believe, in the 50s.
Yeah.
After the second one.
Yeah, she lived a productive professional life, but I think with a lot of misery.
Now, I'm wondering if, I just don't remember enough about the lover, Henry,
Morgan.
Well, yeah, I think he just used her in some ways. I mean, he enjoyed his the aspect of his projection, but didn't give her any guidance. Mm-hmm.
Wrote a lot of this stuff for him. And we've mentioned before in here, Sandy brought it up, that Henry Murray's the one that did an experiment on Ted Kaczynski.
Yeah, right.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I didn't know that, so even though his whole family and story was on 60 Minutes, but they didn't bring up Henry Murray from Harvard.
Well, they did on the PBS documentary on Kaczynski.
I did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I think that's reliable information.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, on the final analysis, it's grace. This is a miracle. If you have been true to the modern dictum of follow your desires, follow your bliss, blah blah, to do so without being destroyed, that's what they don't mention. And if you do so consciously, a shift can occur where you don't have to give up your desire and you can work with it as a tool. But that is a huge accomplishment, because as we've said, the two tendencies are either to repress it or to live it out.
And as Donna Flanagan, you know, he did bring, if the yearning and the longing stays with one another, he suffers. The transcendent function is activated.
Yeah.
And I think that's what.
Philemon's the transcendent function. And we'll see him in the next page, even playing a bigger role in the same spirit. And I can only say, it one day it's not that way, and the next day it is. What happens? I don't know. But sometimes it happens, and sometimes it doesn't. We do everything we can to set the stage, and then it either visits or it doesn't, this change.
Well, for to me, for Jung, the way he didn't run away from
his
family.
Yeah.
And he stuck to it. And he was a tree planted there. you know, and stayed with his wife and loved her too.
Yeah.
Did not dismiss her, did not run off. And,
yeah.
And, I mean, Barbara Hannah said, there's plenty of love to go around.
Yeah.
You know, and so
this is what he's complaining about. You have dragged me through sheer and utter hell. That's his marriage. Or that's what he was suffering, knowing what he was doing to these people he cared about.
And the fact that he just didn't run away.
He didn't run away. So there are steps we take to set the stage. But whether the final change occurs or not, I think, is grace. Yeah, some things, I mean, the biggest thing is not running away. Honestly, honoring both sides, and taking responsibility for the harm you're causing by doing it. All of that would be parts of the prerequisite. And that's what we've seen in this book the whole time. Back and forth. Philemon, Baucis, old man in the wood, young girl, should I be an anchorite? Pulled back to the world. Back and forth. Back and forth. And now we're seeing a center emerge. And we'll see it even more in the next page.
I'm okay with people being in blood as far as sexuality and stuff, but the fucking thing is, war is also a pain in blood, and it's not okay. How do we, if it's only through grace, then how do we stop war?
Well, I think there is a parallel, and that's going to appear, I think, in the next or two pages following. He doesn't exactly say so, but the language is exactly the same. Blood being shed in war and blood being shed in these love experiences. And I think that's something that he would say, a parallelism between the individual's suffering and the suffering of society. Now, this may be Pollyannish, but I believe it wouldn't be too far off to say one of the reasons we have war is we don't pay in blood. And societies that dismiss sexuality, dismiss instinct, are simply creating the condition under which war occurs. Who would go off to war when they're happy with their spouse? You think those soldiers are going off because they are sexually satisfied? No, they're off for adventure.
Those are the drafters.
Yeah, well, but the whole machine is funded by repressed, unsatisfied values. Repressive, unsatisfied values.
Projection.
And projection. Because the anima is projected, every desire involves a projection, and when that is not worked with,
it must be the Iraqis.
It's got to be somebody.
Yeah.
And you know, Jung made that statement that World War I and II was the failure of Christianity. And he was, oh yes, see, we weren't being Christian enough. No, it's because we were being Christian that the wars occurred, because Christianity has left no room for this process. It's bad, end of story. Ask for forgiveness, pass it on to your kids, and sooner or later it breaks out. So that's, I don't know whether that's a valid point, but that's where he's going with it. Yes, there is a need to shed blood. And the question is, how do you do it? So again, you see the implication is the good life isn't the smooth life. It is the life with difficulty and suffering over these issues. If we each own our own, then we take the pressure off the war spirit.
Yeah, because the reason World War I is because power was over the value more than love.
and hypocritical morality.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it's in there.
Yeah.
Because if you really did love, like, everybody has their own definition of love, but if you really love the way he was loving,
mm-hmm.
Like you said, you have to honor both. You don't put one above the other,
mm-hmm.
or your own.
Mm-hmm.
And so there couldn't. You know, it's not like if you do that, you don't have to come to the clash outwardly.
Yeah.
And you have to think of Hitler and his idea of the best race, whatever, mm-hmm. to create the most. Called
Aaron,
you know, superior.
Yeah.
Superior race. It's just so much power, you know, of reasons behind all that.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to think of World War I was the shot to the Ferdinand, one of the
mm-hmm.
So that was the monarchy's like, spurring, mm-hmm. but it just sort of just.
Yeah, yeah, that was really like the straw.
So that, I think he's really trying to find a way not to cancel out the other, you know, the opposites, and that love is really the one thing that can unite. If the other values will topple.
Yeah, and we did this in the Saturday group. I know Carl didn't see it. You didn't see it. So I wanted to show you in Birkhuser's pictures what this development looked like, just very briefly. How there is a shift from paying in blood to paying in wine. Now, so this was just to take about 2 minutes. You guys have seen this, so bear with me. But this is the artist, Swiss artist.
Closed days.
Well, it just differently.
Yeah, that's better. How this looks in somebody else's experience. This is the artist Peter Birkhuser, Carl Linda, that worked with Jung, and this is a one of the first. A picture of one of his very first dreams. And in the dream, he goes into a church and he sees an insect exhale a blue spirit onto the face of his wife. Make a long story short, without going into all the reasons, that insect will be related to an image of divinity. And what it shows is how the anima receives a supercharge of energy at certain moments in life. At the aegis of the self. So when a change is supposed to happen, she'll become eroticized, and within that eroticized condition is a new message that she's trying to communicate. So we didn't really get a clear picture of this guy's behavior, but I'm thinking from the hints that are dropped, he was a supercharged erotic fellow. Now, that shows up in a whole series of dreams of the anima being on fire or being enclosed in flame. Flame. So her burning is his desirousness. Flame. Until we got here. Now the woman isn't on fire but is carrying fire. That's the shift in Birkhuser's life that is parallel to the shift that's going on in Jung's life. The anima and her fire isn't consuming. She is bringing inspiration to him without him being consumed by it. That's the difference between here he was paying in blood. Here you're paying, and why?
So,
don't get to do it. I don't have any background, but you have to just receive what we said. You have to pay in blood.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, I don't know whether he had an affair. I doubt it. I think he and his wife had a pretty good relationship. But I think both of them were pulled by strong tendencies to stray. Whether they did or not, I don't know. But if you look at the hints describing his wife became an analyst, describing his wife, and read between the lines about his behavior, there was a strong erotic charge that wasn't satisfied in the marriage. Even though I think they had a, you know, happy erotic connection. Well, I just wanted to give you an idea, because I know some of us have worked through that Birkhuser stuff. How Birkhuser's process and Jung's process here are parallel. Completely different set of images. But it's, they're documenting a similar change of being possessed by desire versus having desire which you can work with and learn from without being consumed by it, without having it manipulate you. Rather, you can have a relationship to it. So what he's done, he's taken Freudian psychology and he's shown the spiritual dimension of the instinct. That's his response to Freud. Well, Jung, in working this out and then writing on the nature of the anima. And with the added Cora, a creative life is one that has to be in touch with Eros. And always being aware of where your Eros is and what it's trying to tell you. It's both an instinctual and an existential experience. For man or woman. And that we see, we drink red wine. For the first time, we're not drinking blood, we're drinking wine. So that little sentence is huge. Yeah.
Did his wife become a Jungian analyst or Freudian?
Birkhuser's?
Yeah.
A Jungian. Yeah.
He was seeing Jung.
He was seeing Jung. Mostly von Franz, but Jung would see him now and then, maybe to look at fine points of some of his pictures. He painted about 200 pictures in this spirit.
The torch.
Yeah.
It reminds me of the Aquarius, and he's burying the water. Is that kind of an
analogy? Same thing. Okay. Absolutely.
Okay, because it's like you could get inundated with water, too, if you didn't know how to
breathe
in it.
Yeah, you could almost say carrying fire, drinking wine, carrying water are all different images of the same thing.
Okay.
Because, you know, in the symbolic mind, water is fire. Fire is water.
Okay, I've heard that before. Whether
the alchemists would talk about, you know, the water of fire.
Okay.
You're referring to another one of his images, Jane?
No, that one I was referring to, Carl, the one with the torch.
Right, but the one buried by fire, being buried by water. Well, yeah, where did that come from?
Oh, just from astrology. I was thinking, you know, we're into the age of
Aquarius,
and they always talk about, you know, how, well, Jung talks about it in terms of this guy has to bear the water now and carry it, rather than being in the fish tank. Somebody's dream had a fish tank where they were swimming in it. Rather than being swimming in it and not being able to separate out and see what's happening, it's kind of evolved from the fishes to the from Pisces to the water bear.
And you'd be surprised how many dreams I've seen of aquariums breaking, fish flapping around,
And the dreamer has to find a way to contain one or two of those fish. That is absolutely out of the unconscious. You hear this stuff, you think, Yo, where'd you get that? But, right, you see it in dreams. It's really amazing. So that the when in Pisces, the fish are in the water, we are still believers and we're contained in that Christian system. In Aquarius, you don't believe anymore. You experience as an individual component of your psyche what those truths are. And that, again, is a huge shift, which you can't get to without this transformation of Eros.
And, okay, so that's good to me. Yeah. The other thing I was thinking of is this, in terms of this blood and wine, it seems like to me, just based on experience, it seems like rather than it's either or, it's a continuum where it's blood, well, it's half blood and half wine, because you're anguished. You may not act on it on some desire, but you're still anguished by it. Everything stops for a while, and then blood has wine,
yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does make sense.
Okay.
Yeah. And I don't think the anguish goes away when you're drinking wine. It's just you realize you can satisfy this in a different way. You'd sure like to satisfy in blood. But you said, you know, I've been through this before. I don't want to destroy everything in my life. I can get to the same place if I don't concretize the experience.
And like you said, you finally figure out, I don't even want to do that anymore.
I've learned the hard way.
Drop your complex to the dregs.
Mm-hmm.
And then we can move on to being separated out from it and imagining the way through the resolution.
Yep.
A quote that I'm remembering, and I'm not sure if it's the fish and water thing, is the last thing a fish discovers is the water.
Yes.
That
where did that come from?
Well,
what did you think about it? It's something along the lines of, I think I remember where it
comes from. Mousy too.
Oh, well, the one I heard was, you know who discovered water? It wasn't the fish.
Right. It might be a memory stream from a fish.
Maybe.
But yeah, Jung talks about something about people, but yeah. You cannot discover water if you're
finished. Mm-hmm. I read it before I completely got into these streams of reflections, but I can't remember.
It's the same idea that you can't see as an object of reflection what contains you. And so the only way to move forward in relating to religious truths is to begin to doubt them. Then you can take them as something that you have a personal relationship with. Otherwise, they're dictating to you. And this is why religions are so intolerant. Well, now, I don't know if you have any thoughts on this. I don't know what he is saying. We prepare a black chicken. I could not figure that out. Where did that come from?
Burnt offering.
But why a chicken?
A black chicken. Yeah, that is weird.
He said a burnt offering.
Oh, a burnt offering.
Well, the Mexicans, the Mayans, would this was a common domestic animal that they had readily at their disposal. They offer chickens to the gods.
Oh, would they?
Slit their throats and would cook. We would eat them too, but you know.
Well, maybe that's what it is then.
I don't know.
But I was thinking too of like voodoo
always involves
a lot of chickens.
Oh, does it?
Yes, I think so.
Yeah.
Yes.
I remember when I was in college, I went to Haiti, a little missionary trip. And we were sleeping in a church, but we would wake up to hearing the voodoo drums and different things in the morning. And
wow.
The chickens.
Yeah.
Because though they put the chicken foot in the blood, and then they mark the victim with the...
I don't know what all they do with chickens, but they have lots of chicken foot.
Well, anyway,
this feels like a loose association.
Maybe.
Well, they couldn't afford the bulls that the Greeks had, I guess. Or
maybe that's it.
Yeah. You know,
well, in any case, a parallel to drinking the wine is the sacrificial meal.
Bread and wine,
yeah. Fish and wine, you know, Jesus was fish. The chicken would be a religion that is opposite and would be considered by Christianity as devilish, the way I could think. I could be. Yeah, you see, another way to put what we're doing is we're integrating the Mass. The transformation of blood into wine, which occurs in the Mass, is now a characteristic of personal growth. When you transform the need for blood experience, and you're able to satisfy it in a wine experience. That's exactly what's going on. That's why the reference to the sacrificial meal.
I think it's interesting, a few years ago when that big earthquake and there were all those problems in Haiti, and some religious leader here in this country got on the television and said it was because of their voodoo and God's revenge. Mm-hmm. Just so mad at that, because it's not, if you look at the history of Haiti, it's clearly our projection onto blacks that has created the issues in Haiti.
And the reason they're so poor, we took all their money.
Yeah, absolutely.
The French, I think, even, yeah.
But the Western white civilization has destroyed them, and now we blame them.
Yeah.
And it just irritated me. And I know that was during the time that we've been working on this red book, because it came up in class, and I have not saved all of the classes, Catholicness, but we did discuss that in here, I do remember.
I remember too.
I think it's interesting that it's come up again.
Well, let's look at the rest of that sentence. We invite our friends to the sacrificial meal. Now, I think this next bit's important too. Carrying wreaths of ivy and roses. Now, ivy is Dionysus. Roses is love. So pleasure and love have been united. Remember Eliot's, the fire and the rose are one. That's what's going on. Physical and spiritual love are being united. And by spiritual love, I don't just mean for the beloved. I mean as an entry point for creative ideas. The reference to the sun. The sun, remember, at the bottom there was Hat, which was the phallus in the phallus dream of Jung's childhood. So creativity is being honored, and it's the fruit of this process. Which really, again, I think is an enormous, there's enormous implication. You look over on the first sentence in the second column of 344. You carry us up as your soul and set yourself before the Son of God. Creativity has become Christ. Or Christ has become creativity. we have the Son, which was half, and now suddenly it's the Son of God. Well, that's Christ. And the way I understand that is the shift that's going on is the completion of your creative task is the religious act. Yeah. Yeah, well, the Will to Meaning?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And his logotherapy is finding the meaning.
Mm-hmm.
But the Will to Meaning is the most important thing that motivates us in our lives. And but that's why some of those people survive and others couldn't. But the finding the meaning or discovering the meaning would be the creator. That's creativity. Finding the meaning is creativity.
It's a religious shift. It doesn't disregard these religious truths, but it relocates them. Now, she, the soul, is trying to slip off again, the second column. And he won't let her go. Therefore, I did not let her make off, but spoke to her.
A little problem with this, you carry us up as your soul. Whereas I've been thinking the soul is part of, quote, us. It is an archetype. Am I correct in saying that the soul is an archetype? Right?
Right.
So the archetype has its own independent life.
Right.
And carries us up as manifestations of itself, I guess. Huh?
It's muddy. I don't think we're there yet.
Or have we? It may get a little clearer later on.
Well, what I think he's driving at is, you know, for a soul, you're pretty damn soulless. By that, I think he means, look what you're asking of me. Eros, look what you're asking of me.
So you aren't much of an independent archetype. You're kind of dependent on me too much.
Or you're dependent on the self, and you don't care what it costs me to go through your requests. But that's going to change. This is what's at issue at the moment.
Is he kind of grappling with his own conception of the soul at this point?
I think at this point he would say that he experiences his soul through erotic, through the erotic.
The soul would then be feminine.
Yeah. Right. But it is it's an irony, I think, he's facing, that the things that the soul has asked him to do, which are and will be in the long run in the service of humanity and human love, are costing his love relationships a great deal.
And he's trying to get to a point where that stops. And he will. He already is at that point when he talks about drinking wine, but now it reverts back almost as if that sentence hadn't occurred. But that's the way the unconscious works, flipping around. And we won't see it stabilize until page 345. So carry us up. I think us is Philemon and Jung. Set yourself before the Son of God would be the fact that which we saw in the very first picture, where the breath was going from God to the soul. The anima hears the demands of the self and then translates them into reality through eros, by bringing you into contact with a person or persons who can help you move forward in your creative work.
I could have took this part as first she wanted to be in prison, now she wants her freedom again, but the prison or the prison that she has to have is that she has to have a relationship with Jung.
Mm-hmm.
In order, she's not a soul being until she's in relationship and caring about what's important
is,
because he is her soul.
Mm-hmm.
Just as he's trying to figure out his relationship with her as his opposite, she has to try, she is an independent being, she has to try and figure out her relationship.
Absolutely.
And in order for him to have this creative energy, he has to be in touch with his soul. And in order for her to get containment that she needs, and a voice in the world, she has to be in touch with her soul.
And that bridge is being forged in these paragraphs.
And how would you characterize what he represents to her? Gary's just said that you only see her as an erotic element.
I would characterize Jung as her soul, and how she sees him, I'm not really sure, and I don't know that we can really know. But I think she is a soulless being as long as she is not attached to him as her.
Yeah, well, I would say that in that spirit, it's the nature of fire. Does it burn or does it warm? And see, we've been talking about fire all the time, and you think, oh, that's passion. Yes, it's passion, but it's not human warmth. Plenty of people have passionate relationships, and there was that girl who just shot her boyfriend in the head and stabbed him 42 times, you know. That's passion. Terrific passion. But no human warmth. So for Jung to be her soul means she has got to understand not only that she's communicating creative ideas, but that she's communicating human warmth. And he has to have both.
She's the creator of human warmth.
Yeah, so that's why we get in the carrier, that the next bit of this golden vessel that she's carrying and wants to make off with is human warmth.
No, I would say, human warmth takes both of them.
Yeah, look what he says. What holds you back? What are you hiding? Probably a golden vessel. A little farther down. Then I cried in rage, "You're lying, you're lying. I saw the gold. I saw the sparkling light of the jewel." Then a little farther down, near the end of the page. "Alas, I can neither keep it nor conceal it. It is love, warm, human love. That's what she's trying to steal away with. That's also a fruit of the anima. And he's making her realize that. The warm red blood, the holy source of life, unification of everything separated and longed for. And that whole column, she's trying to discount the importance of that, and he repeatedly calls her a liar. That's the first time he has turned the tables on her. Before, every time Salome and the young girl appeared, it was, oh, this beautiful creature. Now he's saying, you're a liar. See how the ego has changed its attitude toward the animal.
So she wants to keep it to herself. She wants to, in a sense, take it from their relationship.
Yeah.
And abscond with it because I think she later says she's greedy for all things,
yeah,
or something like that. You can almost say she's operating under the influence of a masculine spirit, of an animus.
Yeah. Or the self.
Of the self.
Yeah. That's the breath coming off the insect into his wife's face. The blue light, light blue light.
The influence of the self, which she is, in a sense, which inflates her in a sense,
yes,
so that she thinks it's all hers.
Yeah.
And refuses to acknowledge that it evolved from a relationship.
Yeah.
And Jung is asserting his relationship, the importance of the relationship as a creative force behind human warmth.
And that he is a human being living in a human community with responsibilities and human caring here and now. Her point of view is looking to the future. And he's saying, that's great, except I got a wife and kids. I can solve the world's problems. I also got to deal with my marriage problem. And he's realizing he's got to do both. I mean, this is why creative people are often so difficult. The creativity just consumes them, which we can respect, but on the other hand, there's this question of human warmth, which we can't avoid either if we want to be full human beings. I mean, look at Picasso. Just viciously cold to his partners, yet brilliantly artistic. And Jung is not allowing the anima to put him into that position. Because it's the nature of creativity to transcend the moment and bring forth a new viewpoint.
So if there's no Picasso's anima Picasso let his anima get away with it.
Yeah.
When he didn't call her a liar.
Right. Right.
So then, are we saying, I don't even know how to say it, that God is not love?
Well, we're pretty soon going to be saying, and Jane will lead us through this, God's everything.
Okay.
He's love and he's war. He's creation and he's destruction. He's generation and hate. Because the God figure we're going to be looking at is a praxis, who is a composite of bird head and snake body. See what I'm saying?
Okay.
The problem is we have thought God is love. It's funny, I just coming down here today, I was, you know, one of these things that hits you, which you see all the time. The license plate says, "In God we trust." I thought, have you been reading the news? See what I mean? That's one of the things that has to change. Love would be a part of God, but so is war and destruction and hate and lust and yeah.
So what? So love is like our projection.
No, I think it's a genuine component of God, if you use that language.
Okay.
But it has to be extracted from life's experiences. Because if you're in touch with God, you're in touch with many different emotional states.
I think when it comes down to, I'm sorry, my point is, it helps me because the soul is, and God live in this other world,
mm-hmm.
and we live in this world, and we're wanting to relativize and humanize and warm up what's just cold, you know, raw archetypal powers. And we are left with the task of being hit with those.
Yes.
Emotionally in our soul, but then to translate, to discriminate and translate those, and live them out with human warmth and with compassion instead of just having them live through us.
Yes. Absolutely.
You know, let's go to war and kill a million people at their gun. You know, so I think. That's why they envy us so much on that other side. Like
yeah.
Dead, if they haven't lived out their life and their truth and what they were meant to do, because they know that if this on this side is the only way you can like discriminate and live with human warmth and bring it down, all these powers down to an uninflated side. I mean, that's, they're all. It's inflation if we don't do that. And so...
Absolutely. Think of forest fires. They are a creative force of nature. They burn forests, they re-phosphorize the soil, and that's fine unless you happen to live in the forest that's being burnt down. And it's, I think, the nature of this creative process that it sees the long-term benefit of its presence, like a fire. Forest fire is a positive force, basically, if it weren't for people living. But we as individuals have to negotiate around those forces to both respect the usefulness of certain types of fires and also preserve our human community. We should take a break.
I was just going to say, it's hard for me to think of it as God because you do have all of the legacy of Christianity. But I think about nature, you know, an animal will die giving birth or will kill to a safer young, but at the same time, and it's so beautiful and so much love, and it's completely unconditional love, but then at the same time, nature is very cruel, killing, you know,
yeah.
Killing animals, killing other animals for food. And it's both of those. Nature is very beautiful and very cruel.
And so
that helps me.
Because
I think we're so contaminated with the God split that we can't do it.
Right.
Christian
God.
In the water.
Yeah.
Christian
God. Yeah. Another metaphor which has helped me is evolution. I think this creative voice is in the service of our cultural, spiritual, mental evolution. Evolution is a beautiful process, but if evolution wants to wipe out a species, it'll wipe out a species. It's not concerned with the immediate here and now, it's concerned with the long-term trajectory. And as human beings, we have to be concerned with both. Okay, no young fruit. 10 minutes.